Over the next couple of months, we're going to speak about some of the world's most famous and infamous ships. Doesn't matter if they're still afloat, just that they've had an influence. John Litchfield is a long-time correspondent for the London Independent in France and the US, and for our first ship, he's been looking at one of the most notorious battleships of the 20th century.
Just over a century ago, in March 1920, the British government offered an unwanted battleship for scrap. Ship was bought up cheaply, dozens were available just after the Great War, and she went meekly to her fate at Inverkeithing in Scotland for £2.20 a ton. There was no public outcry, no campaign for the preservation of a symbol of British national pride and ingenuity, none of the fuss we would have seen today. The ship was called HMS Dreadnought. Only 14 years earlier, when she was constructed in Portsmouth, in record time and amid great secrecy, the Dreadnought had been the wonder of the world. She was three times as powerful as any previous battleship. She was five or six knots faster than any other large warship. She could fire shells as heavy as small cars to hit targets up to 18 miles away. To direct her 10 12-inch guns, the Dreadnought used the most advanced technology of the day, including a primitive mechanical computer. Instead of the traditional piston-driving steam engines, she used steam turbines, the first large ship to do so. Overnight, the Dreadnought made all navies in the world obsolete, including the Royal Navy, which had conceived and built her. After December 1906, battleships were either Dreadnoughts or pre-Dreadnoughts, and the pre-Dreadnoughts were, in the words of Admiral Jackie Fisher, the British First Sea Lord, now as useful as a sheep in a sea battle. Every navy in the world wanted a Dreadnought, preferably a whole fleet of them. A naval arms race began, which did much to inflame the national rivalries and suspicions which led to the 1914-18 war. Two elections in the UK in 1910 were fought partly on liberal proposals for a rudimentary welfare state, partly on Irish Home Rule, but also on how many Dreadnoughts Britain should build. Winston Churchill, then Home Secretary, said, "The Admiralty demanded six ships, the Economists offered four, and we finally compromised on eight." The Germans engaged in an equally fevered campaign to build Dreadnought battleships until just before the war, when they secretly switched to U-boats. In the 8 years after Dreadnought was launched, Britain built 37 similar or bigger ships, including nine of the faster, less heavily armoured type called battle cruisers. One of these, HMS Glorious, was built in Ireland at Holland and Wolff in Belfast. Same time, the Germans built 24 Dreadnoughts, including seven battle cruisers. The battleship race was not the only or even the principal cause of the murderous, blundering war which began in 1914. But the Dreadnought fever did much to generate a popular and a political mood of suspicion, especially between Britain and Germany, a sense that conflict was inevitable, a sense that we'd better fight them now while we're ahead and we have a chance to win. And yet the Dreadnought, that great floating mountain of iron, that history-making, tension-deepening symbol of British military and industrial power in 1906, was to become a great floating lump of irony. She scarcely ever fired her guns in anger. Her only two memorable pieces of action in 14 years of service were to ram and sink a German submarine and fire her smaller guns at German Zeppelins and aircraft as they flew up the Thames estuary to attack London. Not only did the original Dreadnought achieve little, her many daughters and granddaughters, the later Dreadnoughts and Super Dreadnoughts of the British and German and other navies, proved to be expensive but largely useless toys. They confronted each other in one big engagement at Jutland for 3 days at the beginning of May and the end of June 1916, when they wandered in and out of the mists of the North Sea and the fog of their own guns, without ever coming to the decisive Trafalgar-like battle that admirals on both sides had sought or feared. As a symbol of national pride, as a source of fear and jingoistic competition, the Dreadnoughts helped to change history. As a military innovation, they were the entrance to an expensive dead end or fjord. The future of naval warfare would be determined not by the size, speed, or firepower of floating gun batteries, but under the water by submarines and over the water by aircraft borne by aircraft carriers. None of that was obvious in December 1906, when HMS Dreadnought was first revealed to the public. She was not only a statement of Britain's determination to remain the world's greatest naval power, but also a demonstration of industrial strength. She was built in a day over a year by naval dock workers in Portsmouth, operating six-day, 12-hour shifts on forced overtime. The Dreadnought was conceived by the first Sea Lord, Jackie Fisher, loosely based on a plan put forward in 1903 by an Italian naval architect, Vittorio Cuniberti. Previous battleships looked like a child's drawing of a warship with guns of various sizes poking out in all directions. They carried 6-inch guns, 8-inch guns, 10-inch guns, all of which needed to be close to the target to be effective. The jumble of splashes from missed shots from guns of different calibres made accurate targeting of a barrage in the heat of battle impossible. The need for a revolution in naval construction and tactics was confirmed by the bizarre and calamitous for the Russians, Russian-Japanese War of 1905. The Russian Imperial Fleet, composed of traditional pre-Dreadnought battleships, some old, some brand new, sailed around the world from the Baltic to be sunk by the Japanese. Although the Japanese had very similar battleships, they were somewhat faster, some had bigger guns, they were accompanied by smaller torpedo-firing ships. Cuniberti had already argued that the invention of the torpedo would face naval battles to be conducted at greater distance by bigger battleships armed more uniformly with bigger guns. The Japanese proved his point, or seemed to do so. Admiral Fisher appointed a committee, led by himself, which came up with the design of the Dreadnought, described proudly at the time as the most destructive engine of war ever to be built. She was the first warship to have a uniform array of very big guns, 10, 12-inch guns in five swiveling turrets, firing half-ton shells 14 feet long. She had four coal-fired turbines, each with its own engine room. Her top speed was 21.6 knots, just under 25 miles an hour, or 40 kilometers an hour. To spot and hit targets, Dreadnought had electrically powered rangefinders at the top of her masts. She displaced 18,000 tons, one-fifth bigger than any other warship afloat, but less than half the size of the Titanic, which became 4 years later. She was, in fact, rapidly dwarfed by the Dreadnoughts and Super Dreadnoughts which followed her. The biggest battleships at Jutland displaced 32,000 tons, still less than the Titanic, which was over 40,000 tons, but almost twice the size of the original Dreadnought. Her armament was also by that time obsolete. The biggest ships at Jutland had 15-inch guns, not 12-inch, and more advanced range-finding equipment. That explains partly why Dreadnought played such a minor part in the war that she is sometimes given credit or discredit for fomenting. In truth, all the Dreadnoughts, both British and German, built amid such patriotic fervour in 1906-14, were virtual bystanders in the awful war. The British sea blockade of Germany played some part in Allied victory in the long run, but the German submarine blockade after 1916 almost crippled British and Irish food supplies before convoys were devised. Apart from the score draw at Jutland in the North Sea, 104 years ago, the great battleships scarcely skirmished. The Germans would not risk another battle, even though they performed pretty well in the first. Dreadnoughts had been invented in the belief that naval warfare would be as naval warfare always had been from Lepanto to Trafalgar, based on great engagements between great fleets. No such engagement ever happened after Jutland in either of the world wars. December 7th, 1941, when aircraft and Japanese carriers destroyed most of the American Pacific battle fleet, finally sent the myth of the Dreadnought to the bottom of Pearl Harbor. Two British Dreadnoughts, a brand new battleship and an old battlecruiser, were sunk by Japanese aircraft off Malaya 3 days later. Where are all the great battleships today? One or two do survive in preservation, no British ones. Some of the German high seas fleet of 1914-18 still lies at the bottom of Scarpa Flow in the Orkney Islands, where they were brought to surrender in 1918 and then scuttled by their crews in 1919. And the Dreadnought was cut up in a lock on the Scottish mainland just south of Orkney, melted down and made into who knows what, ploughshares maybe? History sometimes has subplots just like a novel. There's something cheaply ironic in the fact that the HMS Dreadnought's two military actions were to ram a submarine and to act as a floating anti-aircraft platform in the Thames estuary. Another irony, I understand that the first of the new generation of British nuclear missile firing submarines for the UK's updated Trident deterrent will be called HMS Dreadnought. Let's hope she proves as inactive and redundant from birth as her illustrious predecessor.
Thanks to John Litchfield. And that's it for Seascapes for this week. We're back at the same time next Friday. Everything on the programme is podcast. It's on our website, rte.ie/seascapes. If you want to contact me or the programme, the email is seascapes@rte.ie. If you're lucky enough to be on the water over the next week, be safe.